Welcome back to The Bulwark. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by Tony Gilroy, who is, I don't know what to say most famously, because I would say, you know, most famously the showrunner of Andor, which is what we're going to be talking about today, but also the writer-director of Michael Clayton, much beloved Oscar-nominated movie, and my personal, I'm going to say my personal favorite, The Devil's Advocate, writer of The Devil's Advocate. Maybe we can do a few minutes on that later, but we are here today to talk Andor, and I'm very excited to talk about this because it's one of the best shows of the year, and it is getting a lot of award season buzz. Mr. Gilroy, thank you for being on today.
Sure. Happy to be here. I'll be Tony if you don't be good.
Sure. I try to be polite.
No, it's okay.
So I want to start with, a very low level basic question. What is the nature of truth? Because that is what Andor is kind of about at the highest, broadest thematic level to me. And I don't think this is subtext really. I mean, it's very much the text of the show. The text of the show is about a society in which the idea of truth, a shared common truth, is under assault and in decline. And I am curious, I'm curious to get your perspective on how to portray that in art and also how it kind of reflects the world in which we live.
I'm not sure if that's the organizing principle theme of the show. I think there's two things that happen with truth. I think one, obviously, truth is in a power struggle. Truth is up for grabs, and truth is a tool and a weapon. And I don't think the people that are alive right now have ever witnessed anything like the assault on truth that we're seeing in front of us. So I think we're getting a very graphic display of what abuse of truth can be. I also think simultaneously with that, very difficult. I don't know the origin of it, and I don't know exactly how to describe it. There is an erosion of just basic appreciation for truth that seems to be beyond the technique of any faction or any group. I don't know what that's attributable to. I would say that in the absence of any other answers for a lot of the things we'll talk about today, you have to finally say what's different now than it has been. Why does this seem so different? And the only thing you can think of is it has to be social media. It has to be interconnectivity. It has to be fragmentation through the web. I think when people look back, if there are people to look back, I think you're going to have to say what was different about this moment in time. I think that's the only thing that can happen. Now, they don't have the internet in Star Wars. We don't have they have the HoloNet, but they don't have. Mm-hmm. I think you see the Empire in the show very very classically using truth and destroying truth as a technique, as a strategy.
Yeah. Yeah. I think one of the things that's really interesting about the show is, again, you don't have social media and you don't have Google, right? I think Google is a huge contributor to the post-truth society, because as soon as anyone can prove any argument with a string of words in Google, like, show me a study on tax rates on this. Oh, well, it proves this. Oh, no, it proves this. That just destroys everything. But this is a very kind of classic top-down state media operation that the Empire running. And you see it, the best thing that Andor does is it shows everything. It shows us this world through the eyes of ground level people on both sides of the conflict here. So the way you kind of see how this information warfare works is through the eyes of Cyril's mother, which is just a dynamite way of doing it. How, when you were putting these story threads together, was there something in your life that you looked at and saw and was like, this reminds me of what I'm seeing, or just what you're seeing in the world?
Yeah, just what I'm seeing in the world. I mean, I mean, I, I mean, that's, that's the great luxury and that's the great opportunity of the show. I mean, it eats you alive. It's so all consuming, and there's just no, once you're in it and making it, there's no exit from it. You are consumed, but at the same time, the opportunity to scavenge everything that's around you and find a way for the things that are most interesting to you, or the things that you think, you know, would be most interesting to you that would fit into the show. Yeah, everything's up for grabs. And when you're doing a show that goes on over 5 years, you're not just, you know, it's a classic thing in television where you cast your show and you see who works out. And as things go on, I like that actor. I like this character. I like this storyline. You can lean into the things that you like, and you can raise them up as you go along. It's a great opportunity for doing that. At the same time, there's an equivalent ability to keep shifting with the news as it's rolling in at you.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about the structure of the show? Because the first season it's 12 episodes over about a year, right? It was about a year.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then this new season is really almost like four movies, kind mm-hmm. of over each one dealing with a year leading up to the Battle of Yavin, of course, the destruction of the first Death Star. I feel like I'm just throwing words out there that hopefully people understand, but the structure is very different. When you were looking at this second season, what was it? Why did you decide to kind of accelerate things this way instead of doing a season per year?
Well, we were originally, that was the original plan, was to do a season per year. That was the original plan. That's what we sort of said. Okay, we'll do the 5 years that take him into the first scene of Rogue One. So we know exactly where we're going to end, and we have a 5-year tranche of history to deal with. So we'll do one season per year. And this was just, I couldn't overemphasize the ignorance and naivete of a lot of really smart people. I put myself in that category, who thought, okay, this is what we'll do. I really got into this without any real clue of what it would take, what would be involved, what it would cost, the amount of time it would take. So we started the show in a very vainglorious idea. I was going to direct the first 3 episodes. I'd gone to London and was trying to figure it out. We had sort of scripts coming in and we sort of, the first season was laying out, and it's like, okay. Then I think at one point we were going to do 8 episodes, and then they said, wow, we'd like a longer adhesion for this kind of money, so let's do 12. So we're like, okay, we'll make it 12. We move some things around. It's like, okay. And I was just driving a very fast car towards a very big cliff when COVID hit. And mm-hmm. COVID did a whole bunch of things for the benefit of the show. I mean, one for me, I was very, by that point, I think I must have begun to see the consequences, and I was just dreading. I wanted the show to go away. So when COVID came, I was like, thank God, I this was a big mistake, and this will just kill the show. And thank God, this is providentially happening for me. But then when they rallied back and they really wanted to come back, and they were very, really into it and really aggressive about it, it was clear that I couldn't return. I mean, this was that summer. And so I began to do the show. We began to explore the idea of hiring British directors and what would a COVID plan look like? We were trying to figure out, how do you make a show with COVID, as everyone else mm-hmm. was. It was very complex. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of interesting conversation about that. And while that was being developed, we were one of the first people to do it on a large scale, to plan for it. I started the process that is the real process that would be the show, which is really just getting back in and going, oh my God, we're going to make all this. I got to rewrite everything. I have to rewrite everything I've done. I've got to rewrite everything everybody else did. And I just have to start from scratch, and it has to be perfect. And I started to learn how to make the show remotely, very mm-hmm. effectively. And, by the time we got to the spring and started shooting, it was very apparent what we were into. And I went up to Scotland to when I got out of quarantine and went up to Scotland, and Diego and I sat down, Diego Luna, who's playing Cassian Andor, and we were just, there was no, I mean, he would be too old to play it. It would take too long to make the show. Mm-hmm. It would take a decade at least. I mean, it takes us 2 years to make each season. It would take a decade or longer, 12 years to make the show. He'd be too old to play the part. There's a limit to de-aging. And man, I wasn't signing on to die on this show. And we were like, what are we going to do? We have 4 years we have to take care of. And the way our show is built, the way we shoot it, is in three episode blocks. Like a director comes in and does three episodes. That's our, that was the structure that we had been given. And that it's a traditional structure in European television. And so this very elegant solution was just sitting right in front of us. We had four blocks. We had 4 years. Mm-hmm. Like, wow, what if we did a year per block? What would that mean? I go back up to the hotel room and I'm sketching on that for a while. And it's like, wow, I know I'm going to come back on the first one. I want to come back for that wedding. You know, I could stretch the wedding to 3 days. Wow. So the first jump back would be for 3 days. What if I jump a year? If I come back, can I keep it intense again? And I found a way to drop the needle back on each of these 4 year tranches to a very specific 3 or 4 day, 2-3 day period, these intense moments. That's very exciting as a writer. Like, you're like, wow. Then you don't want to get too giddy about it because there's always something ready to bite you. And so I probably right after that, I started to write the top and the tail of each block as a proof of concept. Let me write the first and last scene of each block and see if I can make a structure that works. And then the last piece of it was to say, okay, if we're going to do this, we're going to do it. But our rule is we're never going to come back after that year-long chop and say, God, you know, Sonny, since last time I saw you, you've grown the beard and now you're a doctor. And you know, this Chekhovian stuff that happens at the beginning of so many things, it's really hard for writers to establish things. It's really, it's a very cranky process and it's a real art to hiding exposition and hiding that kind of thing. So that was the rule. Like I said, I don't want one moment of lame exposition. Can we do that? And it was very lucky. And the movie gods were speaking to us and saying this, the math worked out, but it's also very exciting. You know, it's not something you ever have a chance to work on. I'm not sure anybody's ever had a chance to do exactly that before. So everyone gets very excited. The writers get very excited. Everybody gets it's energizing to do that. And then, I mean, to follow the idea all the way through, it also, as challenging as it might seem to be to the audience, or challenging as it seems to keeping the story going, or for the actors, it has a really cool, energizing propulsion to these gaps. You know, it makes everything really intense. You come back and you're there, and it's like bang, and you go, and like, so it really, it was a happy accident with a lot of elbow grease.
It's interesting to hear you describe the propulsive sense between the kind of segments of the show, because this is in a way, this is a show that is very interested in accelerationism, in you know, putting I mean, this is Luthen's whole thing is we got to make things worse. We got to make things worse. And that will eventually turn the tide here. And dropping the audience into each of these crisis moments, one after the other, is a pretty fantastic natural way of doing that, of giving that sense of propulsion of like, here are things that are getting worse. Here's how it's getting worse. Here's how it might get better.
But he's also, I mean, it's also very important that he, you know, the wheels are falling off his program as the show continues. You know, that one of the really big things that we're exploring in this is, I mean, it's a classic. It's true for everything. It's true for every startup company. You know, the people that start off in their garage with an idea and have a great idea, whether it's Silicon Valley or wherever the hell they are, you know, that person who has that idea and has that passion and has that code breaking idea, they are very rarely the correct person to scale up. They are very rarely the right person to take it all the way. And if your brand is secrecy and paranoia and you've been building it in your garage for 15 years, our show episode, our season one is He's Going Loud. I mean, there's a really, one of the really, there's really navigational moments for me when I'm working on something, you know, really big moments that tell me things are going to be okay, or things I have to get to, or things we need to write to. And there's a moment in season one where Denise Goff, Dedra's character, they've just had the raid at Aldani. That's the big heist they've had of the payroll. And it's very unusual, and it's a very huge break, and it's a shocking event for the Empire. And she's very distressed leaving the meeting, the Gestapo meeting there. She's very distressed because they're treating it like a robbery. And her assistant says, "Well, what do you think it is?" She goes, "It's an announcement." And she's right. He's announcing there. And from that point on, he has many successes, and he's totally, in many ways, responsible for anybody for what happens in Star Wars. But his sanity, his ability to manage it, only degrades as we tread further into the show. You know, he really, he doesn't play well with others. He's not a good human resources guy.
No. He doesn't, but he still seems slightly saner than Saw Gerrera, of course, who is really out there.
But I mean, you have your Mao is an accelerationist, right? He was a really big accelerationist. And I can't remember who, my memory sucks, but who was the American journalist who went on the long march with them? Was it Walter Lord? Who was it? I don't know. Yeah, but there's a book, and like, you know, there's a period of time on the long march and all that whole, where Mao is not the farthest out there, but you know, he's not. Mm-hmm. There are other people that are out like past him in terms of he'll appropriate every idea he gets that he likes, but so Saw's, I want to exploit the opportunity to talk about all of these different things and get as many of these ideas in as I possibly, organically get them in as close as possible, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, look, this is a great setting to do it in. I don't think anybody saw this. I certainly did not. I'll just speak for myself. I did not see this coming in terms of the being able to use Star Wars in this way to kind of get into real ideas of rebellion and revolution and what that entails and what it looks like. But the thing that has been, again, the thing that is most interesting about this show from my perspective has been the way that you have both humanized the Imperial bureaucrats and in doing so made them more terrifying, because Darth Vader's a cool character. He's a cool looking character. He talks big, and he's got a great voice, and he's got a cool laser sword, but he's not human in a real kind of identifiable way. Dedra and Cyril are human, and they have desires and dreams, and also are in service of terror. And it's a really tricky thing to do. And frankly, I'm almost surprised that the folks at Disney let you do it, because this is not well-trod territory in terms of how to treat the Empire, which is usually kind of grandiose and cartoonishly evil. This is humanly evil, which is, again, scarier. That's a scarier thing.
What's the question?
The question is when you're sitting down to sketch out how Dedra and Cyril in particular kind of look like for the audience, what is your driving impulse there with them?
I don't change my game for any project. I mean, I want every project to dictate. I've learned not to try to impose a workflow or or a pattern or expectations on every project. I've learned over time that they all want to dictate themselves and how they want to go. But there is a universal platform for how I'm going to work, which is that there are no subsidiary characters. There are no incidental moments in the story. Every single person who arrives must have something almost, you know, I mean, there are people that, I mean, but anybody of any consequence whatsoever, I want to have them be fully realized. And that's on the smallest level as it moves up to characters that you're really going to be taking care of. And really, I mean, I have to live through them. I want them to be absolutely fully realized. I don't have any choice. And I don't have to fall in love with them, but I have to be completely empathetic to their situation all the way through. That's good writing. That's how it gets done. And that happily coincides with a personal philosophy about the nature of evil and the reason that people do things that are wrong and that they know are wrong, and the way that people get seduced by stuff that is stuff that they will die regretting. Those two things work hand in hand in this case. So, you know, the careerism, the insecurities, look at a character like Cyril. I mean, so he's been emotionally terrorized by his mother, right, his whole life, and life is chaos and no father, and God, that emotionally, you know, fascistic household that he's grown up in. So what's he going to gravitate for? Well, why do a lot of people gravitate towards authoritarianism? They have you become the thing that you're afraid of, right? If you're really afraid of the monster, if you become the monster, you don't have to be afraid anymore, right? I mean, that's the classic thing. And so he's kind of a fantasist and he's got a romantic interior life, but he's terrified. And wow, if I become a cop and if I become an ass kick, if I become part of the empire, if I become part of the monster, if I become part of the bigger thing, I don't have to be afraid anymore. And so many people, that is such a, I mean, throw a stone in Washington, D.C. or Mar-a-Lago right now. And my God, why sign on to this death ship? You know, it's because you're afraid of something. What are you afraid of? So that's fascinating to me. So my work rigor and the part of work that is inventing people and making them come alive is also, like I said, holding hands very closely with something that I want to talk about.
You mentioned Mar-a-Lago in Washington, D.C. I feel like we can't avoid talking about this because, you know, when I've discussed the show with friends, I've always kind of poo-pooed it's not precisely a metaphor for Trumpism and blah blah blah. And then, you know, over the last several weeks and months here, we have National Guard in the streets and we've got people being rounded up by ICE. And it's been jarring to kind of try to, going back and rewatching the show over the last couple of weeks here has been jarring, just to see some of the parallels. I know that you're making the show to talk about things you're thinking about, but have you been surprised by how much or how quickly some of this has kind of coincided with the show?
Totally. I mean, look, we've been on a there's people that have been following our selling and commentary trajectory. You know, Diego and I went out about 6 months ago. We started the long lead press for the show six, seven months ago. We got out there. The first little things that we did, Diego Luna and I, we tiptoed into, we got some really provocative questions that we weren't really like, holy shit, we weren't really ready for that. And we kind of went, well, we got to like get everybody tuned up because it's before the election. It's like, what's going to happen? So we, reflexively and defensively trying to protect the show. We're like, okay, we don't want to talk to all the actors who are going to do all the press and do everything like that. And we don't want anybody to violate their conscience. We're not going to tell anybody what to say. But there are ways of talking about the show that are not bullshit and are legit and how we got here and what we're doing. And there are ways of talking about the show that don't pin us down and don't ghettoize us in some sort of way where we're losing some audience that we might really want, or actually people that we want to talk to, so we're not preaching to the choir. And, you know, like, and so we went around the world and really sold the shit out of the show for a couple months. And over time, gradually, as the show was rolling out and as the Trump administration was rolling out and Israel rolling out and Putin rolling out and everybody rolling out, it became a dodgier, a more radioactive concept. But we were also, our corsets got loosened as we went along, as we got near the end. It's like, okay. And no one at Disney ever told us what to do. Honest to God, it was really, I'm sure if we'd gone the other way, we would have heard from them. But we've been so good about taking care of our own business and being very tidy about it. They're certainly aware of everything we're doing, and I think they're appreciative of it. But not a discussion. We kind of self-managed this much of the way through with the publicity people and whatever. And but as time went on, we gradually grew looser. And by the time we got to the end and the show's being released, it's like, fuck this, man. I mean, we've come to the conclusion now, it's their fault. I mean, they're doing it. They're matching the show. Mm-hmm. It's not us. It's not us telling that. Not us saying, hey, look how fucked up you are. It's them going, sort of jokingly, but half wondering, is Stephen Miller watching the show? Are they watching the show and like saying, oh, let's rip Padilla out of the ICE meeting. Let's invade the streets of Chicago. Let's start nationalizing companies by bribery instead of the traditional fact. I mean, I don't know. I don't feel like it's our responsibility anymore. We're totally free now. We could say whatever we want. But there's a whole spectrum of people on the show that have points of view, and Diego's certainly been clear, and other people are on all places in the spectrum. Denise Goff is off in Palestine, and I say what I want to say now. My brother's saying what he wants to say, but I don't feel it's our responsibility anymore. I feel it's, if you're asking me, I'm beyond sad. It's absolutely tragic what's happening, and it is very much. Fascism is fascism, man. When it shows up, it does the same thing every time. It really does. There's a menu, and this is literally there, just going down the list.
I mean, you mentioned Chicago. I assume did you see the thing that Trump tweeted out about, or truthed out, whatever, about the putting
the apocalypse?
Him as Colonel, yeah, the Apocalypse Now kind of mashup with Donald Trump, and loves the smell of deportation.
What a really classic, what a classic example of misreading absolutely everything you're doing. I mean, if you watch that movie and you understand what that movie is about and you understand what that character is about, you understand what's happening there, you have any sense at all, it's just like, the stupidity is staggering. And the fact that stupidity is winning is, I don't even know. Anyway, I saw it. I did. Yeah.
You kind of hint at the cultural illiteracy there. And this is a constant fight all the time. You see it all the time on social media. Like, you're reading this wrong. You're not doing it. You're not understanding. And I think that it doesn't miss the point. It is the point. But at the same time, like, all Donald Trump cares about is that this is a cool image. Look at this cool image. Look at this. This is aesthetically pleasing. And it's aesthetically pleasing to imagine, you know, myself as this big movie character. And people like that scene. And that's the Ride of the Valkyries. And it's great.
Maybe he can napalm Wicker Park. I mean, I don't know, man. You know, I mean, maybe he can, you know, I don't know what. But I'm just as perplexed, if not more perplexed, at the lack of response by the rest of us. I'm just, I'm I wouldn't have a way of writing this passivity. I wouldn't know how to write this passivity into a story. I wouldn't know how to write this level of numbness I should also point this out as we go along, because I don't want anybody to be misinterpreting the political temperature that I would be advocating here. I don't think at all that anything that's going on right now that's disturbing has, I think we've moved so far past ideology. I don't think this has anything to do with left, right, up, down, anything to do with that. And at the tail end of our press, you know, junket, our huge long thing that we did, you know, there were some more provocative interviews where people were trying to categorize the show as left and right. And I was really resistant to that. And I wasn't being delicate about that. I really do believe there's nothing in the show that advocates left or right. There's no one talking. They basically, no one's talking about supply side, or no one's talking about healthcare benefits or property taxes or anything like that. It's people wanting it's, but we have, there's nothing that's ideological about what's happening to me right now. This is literally a moral issue. This is about the ownership of truth the caretaking of truth, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, truth should be like a national park. It should be a treasure. It should be a place that, you know, there should be a, instead of having a Department of War, we should have a Department of Truth. There should be some final, and perhaps with AI, we'll be forced to do that, that there will be some final Bureau of Standards where there will be some, need to be some sort. But beyond that, it's just right and wrong. It's just citizenship and horror. It's just stupidity and intelligence. It's RFK getting up and like, real. I mean, wait till oligarchs' kids start dying from lack of vaccine. You know, I mean,
yeah. No,
we're long past ideology. So I think couching it in left, right, or progressive and even red and blue, the whole thing is wrong, man. There's a binary struggle for whatever morality we have left.
I totally agree with you. I think left and right is not the right way to put it. My friend Peter Suderman, big libertarian, I do another show with him. He has argued very strongly in Andor's favor that it's not about left and right. It's about freedom versus unfreedom, freedom versus anti-freedom, which feels about right.
But decency as well. I mean, just one of the overwhelming ideas in Andor is the destruction of community on every level, on a family level, on a city level, on a cultural level, on a planetary level, on a society, the destruction of all community. It's all the way through where communities are being destroyed and broken up and that's what's happening here. I mean, what community other than a MAGA rally is coming together? Name a community that's forging together, that where people are taking care of each other or doing the things that normally happen in it. Let's get rid of FEMA. Let's get rid of FEMA. And let's get rid of all of the block and tackle and let's get rid of everything that we've learned over the last, you know, couple hundred years about how to take care of people and keep them safe just on a basic level. Let's get rid of all that shit. And let's just everybody just,
yeah.
I mean, I would not know how to write it.
Yeah.
I don't know how to write right now.
Well, the passivity does kind of come through again in Cyril's mother. You see her just kind of accepting what she sees and
absolutely.
What she hears. And I do think there is just a lot there. Look, there.
But well, I'm talking to a different. How many people do we know? I mean, my whole world is just full of people that are just city on fire every moment of their lives. Anytime they turn on the news, it's just everything is absolutely completely upside down. And yet, people are not coalesced in doing anything. I mean, No King's Day, they did the No King's Day. I know they're going to do another one you know, and Indivisible is trying to do that thing and going to try to go out and support them or whatever. I think they have another one coming on October 18th. They're going to do another one, but I've been surprised that they haven't been going. I'm surprised that that happened, that it wasn't like, oh my God, this is going to happen every week now. It's just going to grow and grow and grow and grow and grow. People are, I don't know. There is a line in the first season that, you know, the my Trotsky-ish Nemec character sort of says, you know, the pace of atrocities is so fast that you can't grab onto any one thing. And after a while, you just, you know, you end up, it becomes a blur. I think that's true. It was interesting to hear someone say it, but living through it, it's a little more challenging.
There is a, it's funny, my boss this weekend, Sarah Longwell, she was at one of these protests in DC. She was out marching, and I do think, but it does feel like there has been less of that this time around than the first. I feel like the first Trump administration, there was all sorts of stuff all the time. People,
there were 700,000 people in the Women's Day parade the first day one.
Yeah.
I mean, my God, when he lost the election, when they finally declared the lost election, I live in New York, and like, it was Mardi Gras. I mean, people were out like, if half the people that were there that on that afternoon, I mean, they literally closed down Columbus Avenue. There were fire trucks beeping their horn. Everybody was just like, where is everybody? What happened? I don't know. I know they're going to do another one. I don't know. I'm perplexed. I'm perplexed.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that comes up in the show, particularly in the third sequence, the riots at Gorman, the massacre at Gorman, is this kind of idea that there's a question, I think, the kind of undergirding a lot of this, like, do speeches matter? Does public opinion actually matter at this point? I think one of the Imperial characters, maybe it was Dedra or somebody says, like, it doesn't matter what the public thinks anymore. We're doing this. We're doing this, right. And we're just going forward with it. And I mean, do you get that just sense of fuck it, we're doing it
Well, let's put it this way. How the hell are you ever going to know if you don't try it? I mean, it certainly hasn't been tested. This administration has not been tested with a protest or a general strike or any of the activities of the people. I mean, I really do believe there are more people that think this is fucked than there are people that think this is a good idea. And the idea that they're going to have a Department of War and they're going to do Chicago and we're going to ruin absolutely every relationship we ever had in the world. And I know there's a lot of people in America that don't have passports and don't travel and don't, but it has to be coming home when you look at China and go, well, wow, we're on the outside looking in. Our guys, we're a laughingstock. We have become a joke. America is very, very close to becoming a second-rate power. It's really astonishing. And I don't think that there's a lot of people that want that. And I don't know why that can't be ignited in a way that's effective to scare the shit out of these assholes, to at least hold them in check and perhaps give somebody in that Republican majority some kind of backbone to say this is not going to go on forever and this guy is not going to be alive forever and we're going to have to at some point, I would imagine, face some kind of accounting with our children, our grandchildren, history, something that's going to, and they know what they're doing. They know they're doing the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You don't think that Capitol is full of people that know they're doing the wrong thing. And they're just like, it's just the desperate grab for relevancy and parking spaces.
I don't know, man. I saw a story today the story was kind of framed as this guy who voted for Trump, his wife is from Ireland. She's been a permanent citizen for 28 years or something. And because she got arrested for passing a bad check, she was kiting a check like 20 years ago. She's going to be deported. Like, they did not renew her. And he's like, I regret voting for him. But I look at that story and I just think of, like, who is the ICE agent? Who is the bureaucrat who is signing off on sending this woman back to Ireland? Like, what is that person doing? And what it comes
down to is, It's Cyril.
Well, and so this is it, right? This is what I was thinking about while watching your show. Who is that person? That person is a guy who has a quota. He's a guy who's got a quota. I got to get rid of this many people this week. And here's somebody I can get rid of. That's one name. That's one number. Dude, that's one hash mark.
I mean,
on my list.
Absolutely. Patton Oswalt, I saw right away, did a thing about the ICE agents. I don't know where it was, but what show was he on? And he did a whole analysis of where these ICE agents were coming from. I mean, yeah, they're getting off their mother's couch and they're strapping on their Amazon camo, and boy, I hope on October 18th, that's going to be my pitch. October 18th, I hope people go out. I really do. I really hope that something ignites. I don't think waiting for the midterm elections, I don't think waiting for Trump to die, I don't think that these are viable. I don't think it's enough for people to protect the things that they, if they really care about the things that they've had all these years, I don't think that this is a, and like I said, but it's very painful to watch muscular patriotism be appropriated by a bunch of fucking idiots and draft dodgers and wimps and all these faux macho, brigade that's tromping around steakhouses and smoking cigars and patting each other on the back. The appropriation of muscular patriotism is really that's another tragic loss to me.
Yeah. All right. I want to bring it back to the show just for one second. I got distracted there. I shouldn't.
No, it's all right.
A friend wanted me to ask, and I think it's a great question. Wanted me to ask I know who the credited writer is. Your brother is a credited writer on the script. But who wrote the line, "Who are you?" The episode title, the same name.
That would have been, that would have been me. I mean, it was a little controversial because a lot of people didn't believe that it would, a lot of people on the set and a lot of questions as that was coming up to be shot. And, wouldn't Cassian remember him from back in Ferrix? And is it appropriate that he wouldn't? And I was just like, I fought for that a long way. And finally I just like, cause it is my show. So I finally was just like, you know what? I'm naming the episode. I'm telling you right now, that's going to be the title of the episode. So, you can shoot an alt if you want. That's how we do the show. It's like, if you want to shoot an alt, you can shoot an alt, but shoot mine first. And then you can shoot the alt and don't lay down on mine. And cause I'm telling you, that's what I'm going to do. And so it was a little bit, but I don't know if I'm sure Danny was into it. But I'm pretty sure that came from, it just seems so Greek, you know, it's so elementally Greek. It's just, you could ask that question of every single person in the character in the show. Who are you, man? It's who are you? I asked the same question it's kind of ripping myself off. There's a scene in Clayton where Tom Wilkinson has all this bread. He's crazy in the thing. And the Clooney character's sort of saying to him, you know, you got to come in and do all this stuff. And he says, and Michael Clayton says to him, I'm not the enemy. And he says, well, then who are you? It's the same. Who are you? It's, it's the same thing as putting a mirror up in a scene for an actor. You know, it's a cliche. It's tired. At the same time, it's always fresh because we all live it and it's real. You know, it's like, what are you doing? Who are you?
Yeah. All right. I always like to close these interviews by asking if there's anything I should have asked, if you think there's anything folks should know that we didn't discuss about the show, about what you got coming up, the world, whatever. What did we not discuss that we should have today?
Oh, I don't know. I would say that I think from doing the show, from living so thoroughly through the show and through what these characters go through, and really, because you really live it, so you're really in it, and really facing your own limitations and where you're weak and where you're a wimp and where you fail. I think that I don't know exactly how courageous I am. I don't know where I have fantasies about what I like to think about how courageous I would be and what I would fight for and what I would sacrifice. I've had to live through a lot of characters that have done that. I do think that courage and sacrifice feel really good. They do feel good when they're there. And I think people forget. I think it's an appetite that people, they don't taste it for a long time and they forget how good it tastes. And I think that it's also a muscle that if it doesn't get used, it atrophies. And I think that's the state that we're in right now. I think people have forgotten how good it feels to be courageous, how good it feels to make a sacrifice, how good it feels to stand up for the things that you know are absolutely right. And how much of everything that we ever had is based on somebody's sacrifice. And the idea that we're going to get a gift card and not have to pay any rent, I don't know. That's my message at the end, I guess.
Yeah. Andor is now streaming in full on Disney Plus. We got Emmy voting coming up.
It's over. No, it's the Emmy voting's Emmy, over.
Emmy
it's
voting,
over.
Emmy voting's
we had Emmys
guild,
last night.
Guild voting coming up.
The guild voting. No, exactly. Yeah. No, the guild. The guild.
So if you're in a guild, throw it on there. Make sure you support it. But I have to say, I was blown away by this season. It's great.
Thank you. We're very proud. Very nice having you on.
We didn't even get to the Devil's Advocate. Maybe I can get you back on the show next year for the 30th anniversary.
We'll do a review. Okay. Okay, man. There's a lot to talk about there. All right. Really nice to meet you, man.
And again, my name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark, and we'll be back next week with another episode. We'll see you guys then.